Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 42. 2 years. The 2 years, 1897 and 1898, were for Mrs. Eddy, very notably, years of attainment. Out of the turmoil with which she was constantly beset, she brought to fruition two plans which she had long been maturing. The establishment of the Christian Science Publishing Society, on a sure basis as an irrevocable trust, and the founding of a weekly magazine in the form of the Christian Science Sentinel. They were years, too, of many other outward and visible signs of expansion. In the summer of 1897, she received a great assembly of Christian Scientists, to the number of some 3,000, at Pleasant View, while towards the close of 1898, she gathered around her in Concord, on two bleak November days, a group of chosen men and women students, summoned for what she evidently designed as a new missionary effort, to whom she delivered what was to prove her valedictory in the matter of class teaching. The gathering at Pleasant View on the afternoon of Monday, 5th of July, 1897, must have had about it an inescapable air of triumph, of joy at last in the morning, after a very long night of struggle and no little sorrow. It was Independence Day, for the 4th, falling on a Sunday that year, the national holiday was kept on the following day. In order to avoid anything in the nature of a pilgrimage to Concord from distant parts of the country, Mrs. Eddy had not issued her invitation until the Sunday morning service the day before. Addressing her letter to My Beloved Church, she wrote, "I invite you, one and all, to Pleasant View, Concord, New Hampshire, on July 5th at 12:30 p.m., if you would enjoy so long a trip for so small a purpose as simply seeing Mother." The letter, however, was dispatched from Concord on June 30th, and somehow or other, news of its contents got abroad almost immediately, and word was telegraphed to newspapers all over the country, with the result that hundreds of Christian Scientists from as far west as Kansas City set out at once for Boston. On Sunday morning, the Mother Church was thronged. The first reader, after reading the letter already quoted, gave notice as to the arrangements that had been made for the journey to Concord, the time and place of departure of the trains, the cost of tickets, and so forth. Trains were to leave Boston at 9:30 in the morning. Ushers were appointed to show the way to the cars. The sale of tickets was provided in such a way that all could be accommodated. July is one of the hottest months of the year in Boston, and the heat almost proverbially reaches its peak on Independence Day. This year was no exception. As the heavily laden special trains pulled out of the North Station, there was every indication of the wrath to come, and it was amply fulfilled later on. All of the newspaper accounts of the matter dwell on the heat, but also on the fact that nobody seemed to care what the weather was like. When the trains arrived at Concord, the travelers, numbering well over 2,000, found every available vehicle that could be requisitioned in and around Concord, waiting to carry them to Pleasant View. And by 12:30, the entire party had reached its destination, and the visitors spread themselves over the lawn beneath the tower window. All Concord joined in the celebration. The Honorable A.B. Woodworth, Mayor of the city, was present in the chair. And about 1 o'clock, Mrs. Eddy came out of the house, accompanied by the chairman of the board of directors of the Mother Church, Edward P. Bates. Very many of those present had never seen her before, and pressed eagerly forward to get a glimpse of her, as cheers of greeting went up from all sections of the crowd. The mayor was the first to speak, and his commendably short address served to indicate not only the standing which Mrs. Eddy had by this time attained in her own community, but also the personal regard in which she was held by those who did not share her faith. "Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure," said the mayor, "to comply with the request of Mrs. Eddy, that as mayor of Concord, I should welcome you to our city. This I do with the most cordial feeling possible, for I recognize the fact that I see before me a great company of men and women who have come from all parts of the country to express their devotion to the religion of God and of Christ, the great healer, as it has been the more clearly revealed through the insight and the power of her who has bidden you here. May this day be one long to be remembered as the occasion when you saw her whom you most delight to honor, in her beautiful home and surrounded by the charming scenery she loves so well." At the conclusion of the mayor's address, Mr. Bates remarked that the audience needed no introduction to Mrs. Eddy, nor she to it, as all knew her, though some had never seen her before. And then Mrs. Eddy spoke in her usual calm, unhurried way, and in a voice which carried to the limits of her audience. In the atmosphere of all that had grown up around her and her teaching, it must have been an impressive scene. The Boston Herald, in a report of the matter, presents a vivid picture. The view over the valley bathed in sunshine, the blue summits of the distant hills, and the great throng in bright summer clothing, set off against a background of green. And then the tall, slim figure of Mrs. Eddy, clad in lavender and black lace, outlined clearly against the shadows of the veranda. "The profile," said the Boston Globe, "is sharp and keen. The face in full view is extremely delicate and tender. Motherly more nearly expresses it, and her hair is silver white. She wore her badge of ruby and diamonds as a daughter of the American Revolution. Mrs. Eddy's address on this occasion, afterwards republished in her book Miscellaneous Writings, is one of the most interesting of her public utterances. In many ways, as might be expected, it is a quiet paean of triumph. "Today," she said, "we commemorate not only our nation's civil and religious freedom, but a greater even, the liberty of the sons of God, the inalienable rights and radiant reality of Christianity, whereof our Master said, 'The works that I do shall he do,' and 'The kingdom of God cometh not with observation, with knowledge obtained from the senses, but the kingdom of God is within you, within the present possibilities of mankind.'" Then she went on, with no little eloquence, to tell how from the falling leaves of old-time faiths men might learn the parable of that hour, namely, that all error, physical, moral, or religious, would fall before truth demonstrated, even as dry leaves fall to enrich the soil for fruitage. And so she spoke for some 10 minutes or more. And then, with that indescribable ease which was one of her great attractions, she spread out her hands to the audience, and having turned for a moment to those who were beside her on the veranda, she concluded, "Friends, I am not enough the new woman of the period for outdoor speaking, and the incidental platform is not broad enough for me. But the speakers that will now address you, one a congressman, may improve our platforms and make amends for the nothingness of matter with the allness of mind." There were more speeches and letters and telegrams. The last speech was that by General Erastus N. Bates. As will be remembered, he was a veteran of the Civil War and had been a man noted for his courage. With all the simplicity of a soldier, he told what he owed to Christian Science, how at the close of the war he had returned to his home a physical wreck, his days numbered by his friends and physicians, his own expectation of life limited to a very short time, how Christian Science had brought him out of what was virtually his grave, and how, knowing this, his audience would not wonder that his heart should now overflow with love and gratitude toward her whom, in an especial sense, he owed the preservation of his earthly life, so that he had now reached well nigh his, not 3, but 4 score years and 10. The meeting which assembled in Concord some 18 months later was very different in character. The gathering at Pleasant View on Independence Day had been a veritable jubilee of achievement. The meeting in November of the following year was the inauguration of new labors. Mrs. Eddy, full of plans for the future, sought to determine the materials she had to work with. In other words, to review her resources and find out by personal test whom she might count upon to be faithful. The problems to be met were many. She was confronted with a tremendously expanding movement. An experience in the past had shown her that nothing was more dangerous to orderly progress than zeal without knowledge. As far as her own personal contacts with the movement were concerned, she had been steadily withdrawing for over 10 years with mixed results. As far back as 1888, in a letter to the National Christian Scientist Association, she had said that for 2 years she had been gradually withdrawing from active membership, and that this policy on her part had developed higher energies on the part of true followers, and led to some startling departures on the other hand. Similar registration of advantage and disadvantage was characteristic of all the years that intervened. Mrs. Eddy's great and increasing difficulty, as the movement developed, was to find men and women capable of faithful service and work, without entering into the age-old competition as to which should be the greatest. Late in 1898, she determined upon an inventory. And so, on Tuesday, November the 15th, she sent out an identical telegram to some 60 or 70 of her students scattered east of the Great Divide, telling them that if they would be in the Christian Science Hall in Concord at 4 o'clock on the following Sunday afternoon, November the 20th, she would have a great blessing in store for them. If nothing else, it was a test of obedience and willingness to act without question. And it was successful, for every one of those thus invited immediately set out for Boston and Concord. They came from as far west as Kansas City, from as far south as Memphis, and as far north as Toronto. Some of those invited reached Concord only just in time, but the great majority were present at the Sunday morning service in the Concord Church. No one knew it at the time, but later many of them looked back with interest on the fact that the reading from the Bible at that service was the 10th chapter of Luke, relating the sending out of the 70 disciples. By 4 o'clock in the afternoon, all those invited had assembled in the Christian Science Hall. Mrs. Eddy was not present, but Edward A. Kimball from Chicago, who was rapidly coming into prominence in the movement, stepped up on the platform and read a letter from Mrs. Eddy, explaining that she had not in advance divulged the purpose of her summons, as she did not wish to stir up those others who would wish to share this opportunity. The purpose? This representative group was to receive from me one or more lessons in Christian Science. The number to be determined by the results shown, but in any case not to exceed 3. The work, designed to impart a fresh impetus to the movement, would be without money and without price. In the years to follow, A cloak of mystery was to be drawn about this memorable event. But at the time, it was regarded as anything but esoteric. Two newspaper reporters, one of whom at least was never a Christian Scientist, were among those invited, and no one was pledged to secrecy. Many recorded the experience in considerable detail, and since there is virtually no disagreement as to the content of the material covered and on the general impression created, the reader of today is not without an accurate picture of an historic moment. Mrs. Sue Harper Mims, the Atlanta teacher, describes the class as principally an examination with some teaching. Arriving promptly at 4, Mrs. Eddy spryly and gracefully mounted the platform. Her snow-white hair, in loose waves or curls about her forehead, was uncovered. Handsomely attired in a skirt of black moire and a waist of white silk covered with net, and heavily trimmed in jet, her cape was thrown back to reveal the large diamond cross given her by Mrs. Stetson, and the diamond and ruby badge of the D.A.R. Against the red plush chair, she was a striking figure. Her gestures, as always effective, were accentuated by white kid gloves, which she did not remove. In her greeting, she said she had been waiting 15 years to meet such a band of faithful workers. Then, without more ado, she got down to the business on hand by asking each one in turn, "What is God to you?" The replies, largely in words borrowed from Science and Health, elicited little comment. But when one hapless youth defined God as life, truth, love, and also destruction, he was gently but devastatingly asked, "Will you tell me how God is destruction? Is there anything but God? What is there to destroy?" It took quite some time, naturally, to get around the large class, but this session was to last 2 hours, and there was still some attention reserved for other matters. "You have told me wonderful things today," Mrs. Eddy said, "and now you must live up to them. If science was to be practical, they must prove their precepts by works rather than words." For herself, she had 3 times raised the dead, she assured them, and cited one instance. She was sent for by a woman crying that her child was dead. Putting the mother out of the room, she took the child up into her arms and prayed. In an hour, she called the mother back, and the child ran to meet her, restored not only to life, but to health. The very first revelation that ever came to her, she recalled, was that she could not die. She saw life, and that it was impossible for her to die. She went on to relate how those who merely called for her were healed before she could get to them, and then were loath to admit that God heals. So anxious was she to have them acknowledge the truth that she said to herself on one occasion, "He, the patient, must not get well until I get there." This one did not get well, even after she got there, and it was a bitter lesson for her. When I reached home, I threw myself on the floor, put my head in my hands, and prayed that I might not be for a moment touched with the thought that I was anything or did anything, that this was God's work, and I reflected Him. There was a pause, and then the students, one after another, stood up to recite their experiences. Judge Hanna said that he, too, had raised the dead. Several spoke of revelation coming to them as a marvelous burst of light, some describing it as literally flooding science and health as they read. The scene in the little hall was so impressive that when a Dr. Stockman rose, he was too overcome by emotion to speak. Before closing, Mrs. Eddy had a few words to say on supply. "Because God is all, man cannot lack. When one stands before a mirror, the reflection is the same as the original. Now, you are God's reflection. If His hands are full, your hands are full. If you image Him, you cannot lack." The class had been so very satisfactory, their teacher observed as she left the platform, that there would be but one more session, this to be held next day at 1 o'clock. The second and final session lasted about 4 hours and emphasized, according to George Wendell Adams, the basic and vital truth that one infinite principle can only be manifested as one infinite idea or reflection, which, of course, was the compound idea man. How, though, to get down to cases, is instantaneous healing to be done? Many were the answers to this question, ranging all the way from realize the ever-presence of God to deny the claims of evil. When all had been heard from, Mrs. Eddy smilingly said the answer was simple. It is to love. If one lives love and knows only love, nothing is impossible in the way of healing. Be nothing but love. But was not the practitioner required to discriminate between good and evil? Ah, yes. Not only must he, like Jesus, love righteousness, but by the same token, he must hate iniquity. Bearing out this theme, she was later to denounce to John Lathrop the three monkeys: see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, as a symbol of heathen philosophy, saying Christian scientists do not close their eyes to evil, but open them. Those who were unable or unwilling to recognize error as something to be corrected, she found unteachable. The general tendency, on the other hand, to become fascinated with error instead of going on through to the truth, she dismissed with the story of the man who killed a fox, stuck its tail out through a hole in the door, and then laughed at the crowd, which soon collected to discuss how the fox got through that little hole. Human beings were always trying to find the reason for something that never happened, she concluded. At another point, she said, "In the human, it is good to think of God as our Father and Mother, with us every moment, giving us everything good and beautiful, caring for our human bodies." Divine provision was like a scale, she explained, with infinite good on the side of spirit. Everything put into the scale of spirit would be on the side of infinity, while everything put into the scale of matter weighed on the side of limitation. The Trinity of old was now to be understood as life, truth, love, wherein man reflects all that God is. With God triune, man must be triune, the idea of life, truth, love. As an afterthought, she was to send each student a written statement on the Trinity, defining Father as man's divine principle, Son as his spiritual idea or image, and Holy Ghost as divine science, making Jesus in the flesh the way-shower to life, truth, love, while out of the flesh, Jesus was the Christ. Dismissing as absurd the literal interpretation of the Bible, she said it reminded her of the farmer who claimed scriptural authority for refusing to let his hired hands go for water on a hot day. "Ho, everyone that thirsteth," was the biblical injunction, he insisted. Who among those present would like to translate for her into the new tongue some passage from the Bible? The youthful John Lathrop asked about the women who brought sweet spices to the tomb of Jesus, said, "Well, Mother, you know they were women, and women have the highest idea of God." But Mrs. Eddy was heard distinctly to murmur, "I don't know about that." She let him finish, and then she asked Mrs. Mims to come up onto the platform with her. "I want them all to see you. The stone that was rolled away from the sepulchre," Mrs. Mims volunteered, "was the concentrated human belief that life was limited. And removing this stone meant seeing immortality." But Mrs. Mims had something else in mind, and here was the ideal opportunity for bringing it out. "Those at the tomb, disciples of another day, saw what our beloved mother has, through science and health, enabled us to see. Through this book, we have seen all that they saw and more. And we owe it all to her, this beloved one, who is God's messenger today." Like an awaited signal, This brought a flood of tributes from the assembled students. "How could we forget you?" was heard on all sides. Judge Hannah came to his feet again, this time to say that in his position he was such a target for evil that blackness hid the horizon, except when he turned to Mrs. Eddy as the revelator for this age. Few, if any present, failed to voice the same thought. "My dear children," Mrs. Eddy said when they had all finished, "if you had not seen it, I should have had to teach you this. I could not have avoided telling you that when my students become blinded to me as the one through whom truth has come to this age, they go straight down." Tears of joy were upon her cheeks, according to the written accounts, and she brought her class to a close with the joyous benediction of one who has drunk deeply of the holy grail that is a sacred goal attained. These two meetings in Concord are perhaps specially important to the purpose of this record, in that they afford an interesting glimpse of the inner life of the Christian Science movement about this time, and of Mrs. Eddy's relation to it. The struggles and trials, defections and disloyalties, which seem to crowd themselves into every period of this woman's life, were, it now becomes increasingly clear, very far from being the whole of the story. Back of them all, and apparently quite unaffected by any of them, was a tremendous development constantly reaching new expansions, only to exhibit unmistakable signs of going on further still. Some 20 years before, Mrs. Eddy had written in her book, Science and Health, "Undisturbed amid the jarring testimony of the material senses, science, still enthroned, is unfolding to mortals the immutable, harmonious, divine principle, is unfolding life and the universe, ever present and eternal."